We are back. I'm Paula Gordon. Bill Russell and I are with Janine Abdo, and we are in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we're talking about Egypt and the Middle East. You brought up the subject of Iran. You have a great line in your book, No God But God, that talks about Iran as being philosophically Islamic, where Egypt is religiously Islamic. That may not be an exact quote, but take me through that. What is the difference? They're both basically the same religious community, and yet you say that's very different in the way they live out that religious commitment.
Iranians are very religious people, and they have been for centuries. But what is different in terms of how religion is expressed publicly in the newspapers, just on television, what's out there in the public debate, is this philosophical orientation. And that really comes from the difference between Shia Islam, which is practiced in Iran, and Sunni Islam, which is practiced in Egypt to some extent. And I don't want to place a lot of importance on that. But for example, what Iranians study in their seminaries, where they learn about religion, and where young men who, for example, and women who want to become theologians, what they study is based a lot on philosophy. It's based both on Islamic philosophy, and there were many famous Islamic philosophers over the centuries, and also Western philosophy. And you don't have this focus and importance placed on philosophy in the Shia seminaries as you do in the Sunni ones in Egypt, for example.
There's also a difference that we forget about. We tend to think that all Muslims are Arab and all Arabs are Muslim, neither one of which is even close to the truth. And Iran is not an Arab country. You're Persian. Yes. And is that any piece of it, or is that just sort of a subtext, or does it matter?
Well, I think that the way Iranians and Egyptians view their religion, of course, is very influenced by geography. In Iran, for example, over the last several centuries, there was a great influence from India. There was, and where Sufism, for example, and mysticism was very pronounced for centuries in India. And there has always been this great relationship between Persia and India. So there has always been a very vibrant Sufi tradition, or there was, in Persia. Not so much now in modern-day Iran. You don't really see that so much in Egypt, and you don't see the influence of Sufism in Egyptian culture. Certainly there are what's called mawlids, whereby Sufis in Egypt, they come every year. It's a festival. It's historically a religious festival. And Egyptians from the countryside celebrate the mawlid every year by coming to Cairo. And they bring their children, and it's become more of a picnic now rather than a serious religious ceremony. But there are, of course, very visible signs of Sufism. But it didn't have the same long-term effect in Egypt that it had in Persia.
And that's the mystical tradition.
The mystical tradition. But this is just one of many examples that distinguishes.
So we might all do well to have a geography lesson and see how things are connected.
The impression, I think, those of us who would think about Egypt is that they're fundamentalist and they're secularist, and that covers the subject, and the secularist won.
Does that represent every stereotype?
And the core of your book is, you start out by refusing to use the word fundamentalist for reasons that I'm sure you'll be glad to share. but the richness of that and your... in a way, prescription is startling.
One of the reasons I wrote a book about Egypt, or some of the reasons are the ones that you just described, because I really believe that Americans have, and the English-speaking world in general, has such a false idea of what this country is. In theory, the government is secular. And by that, I mean it is not a government that we see, for example, in Afghanistan, or we see in Saudi Arabia. The Egyptian constitution says that the Sharia, which is Islamic law, should be the basis of all legislation. Now, that isn't always implemented. It was written into the constitution about 20 years ago to appease this growing Islamic movement that was
becoming
more powerful.
That would have been in the 70s.
I think it was actually written into the Constitution, if I remember correctly, in 81 or 82.
Was that before or after Sadat was killed?
It was before Sadat was killed.
So it was part of his trying to come to terms with the aftermath of the death of Nasser.
Yes, and also it was part of his alarm and concern about this growing Islamic movement, which, of course, the militants in the end actually assassinated him, as we know. But one of the reasons that I wrote a book about Egypt was to try to explain the reality of this country, which I think has been completely misinterpreted in the United States. And the reason, I think, part of the reason that we have a different idea of what is Egypt is because of the impressions our own government, the U.S. government, because of the impressions they want to perpetuate about this country, that it's our friend in the Middle East, that we can always count on the Egyptians to counter people like Osama bin Laden, that we can always rely on the Egyptians to counter the growing anti-Israeli sentiment, because, of course, Egypt made peace with Israel. But all of these kinds of impressions are really myths in many ways.
Well, and some of them sound remarkably like what we were saying about Iran back in the 70s.
Before the Shah was overthrown.
Before the Shah was overthrown. And the parallels, at least, is you know, reading through what you've written, are in some ways striking. The alienation between the government and the people is even more striking than I would have thought. And that's, you know, that is not an uncommon problem in the Middle East. But I think what struck me most was, I think early on you say that the best hope, I'm paraphrasing, I think, but the best hope for the future of Egypt resides with the Islamists, those people who you refuse to call fundamentalists.
Okay, tell us why you won't call them fundamentalists. Go ahead and tell us.
Well, I don't call them fundamentalists because of the way the term is interpreted in the English language world. When we say fundamentalist, everyone understands that that means violence. It means people who want to return to some sort of medieval existence. And this is completely far from what the Islamists, whom I wrote about, want in their lives and what they want for Egypt and any future government. First of all, they're very modern people. They don't want to return to some sort of era that resembles the Prophet Muhammad. They don't want women to wear veils necessarily. They say that they wouldn't make veiling mandatory. They're not going to pass laws whereby thieves' hands would be cut off, as we see in Saudi Arabia. So they're just trying to find some way to modernize Islam and to create a system whereby the Sharia Islamic law would actually be applied in the courts and it would be the basis of law in Egypt. And also, frankly, they want to create a democracy that doesn't exist in Egypt.
That was one of the most striking things that I came across in your book, this sense that one could create a democracy, A, that B, it isn't a democracy, which I think our government has helped us in America. Well, of course, Egypt is a democracy.
Yes.
All of these things, it's like the two sides of a coin. Every time that I think of one of these things that I think I know about Egypt and the Middle East, I have to turn it over and say, well, no, it's not. How can one take what is perceived as a very conservative religion and make that the basis of democracy? How can that be done?
It wouldn't necessarily be a Western-style democracy, and that's an important distinction. And again, it's our inclination to try to turn all of the countries that we're talking about into Western democracies, even though part of the problem that's being played out now is that we are seeing that Islam as a religion is incompatible with a Western-style democracy. It's even incompatible, many people argue, with the whole idea of a modern nation state. And many of the countries that were carved out from the Ottoman Empire that became nation states, now we're seeing many decades later the effect of this process. And how do you have a thriving religion that is so much part of people's lives, a religion that includes politics in a Western definition of what a state should be?
Where the separation is just unspoken and a basic.
Well, it's assumed. Yes. And the answer is?
And the answer is that it can't be done, probably. And so the Islamists that I write about in Egypt, they want to have what they're advocating are very basic rights. They want to have free elections, for example, that haven't existed in Egypt.
I want to come back to all of those things that the Islamists want that are basic fundamentals to democracy but don't look a thing like what we think of when we think of it in the West. Please be with us when we return with Janeed Abdo, and this is Bill Russell, Paula Gordon Show. We'll all be back momentarily.